Our two guests tonight are Clifford Dirksen and J. Fred McDonald, who will be fully introduced in just a moment. But J. Fred has brought all the material that we're playing tonight, and you've got to explain, what was that strange sound?
That was a song from the mid-1920s all about the new phenomenon of radio, which was beginning to sweep the nation locally and then eventually as a network medium by the later part of the 1920s.
And who was that masked man singing the song?
I'm not really sure. I think it was... The name wasn't associated with the clip when I picked it up.
But so. The lyrics, as near as one could hear them, involve a kind of a running complaint about the content of radio programming.
It was the difficulty of hearing with all the static, and they used to have sometimes one night a week. They would have the local stations would go off the air. They called it a silent night, so you could pick up stations elsewhere because not necessarily good was the local reception.
Now, we are tonight going to focus on radio at its beginnings in this country and then how it transformed and matured, or at least how it developed over the next few decades. My guests are J. Fred McDonald, who's an old friend and has been here often. He is professor of history emeritus at Northeastern Illinois University. He took retirement early because he also is the president of McDonald and Associates, an historical film and radio archive, very important in the broadcasting world, actually. And he's given his full attention to that in recent years. He is as well the author of a number of important books, and your first history of American radio was titled...
Don't Touch That Dial.
Wonderful. Coming, I think, from Fibber McGee, isn't that right?
No, the opening to the Blondie show.
Oh, to Blondie, Blondie, of course, Dagwood. Clifford Dirksen, who's a regular... gig is as a critic at Time Out Chicago, a very interesting recently established magazine, is the author of a new book titled American Babble, Rogue Radio Broadcasters of the Jazz Age. I should tell you, Cliff, when I looked at the full title, I felt there was something missing. The title should be American Babble or Indiana Jones and the Rogue Radio Broadcasters of the Jazz Age. There's something rather adventurous about that title.
We tried to put a little juice in it. I think the original title was The Cultural Politics of American Radio Broadcasting, 1920 to 1933.
That would have been the title on your PhD dissertation.
My editor told me, he said to me, I thought you said you wanted to sell some books.
Exactly.
So I was talked out of that.
He was right. I love Rogue Radio Broadcasting.
Rogue had a nice sound, and Jazz Age is always good, too.
Yes, so. Indeed. Yeah. It's rather like... The advice given was to a young author who didn't sell well, and they told him it's got to be about Lincoln or about doctors or about dogs. And he then wrote a book titled Lincoln's Doctor's Dog.
Right.
let's begin to look at the basic facts. What is the first commercial station in American radio? When are the first broadcasts undertaken?
It's a really difficult thing to put a first to. All these sort of encyclopedia firsts, the facts as given in a textbook would say that it was station KDKA in Pittsburgh, which was a Westinghouse concern, and that goes on the air in, I think, November 1920. But if you look at the inspiration for that experimental broadcast, there were already what were called wireless amateurs who were doing something very like broadcasting. They weren't calling it broadcasting, but they were basically, these were nerdy science tech fans.
And who was listening to them?
Other radio, other wireless fans.
Other nerds.
Yes, other nerds. There's a little, they basically, this begins with radio telegraphs, with Morse code. By about 1906, 1907, the night sky is filled with the chatter of these boys just talking back and forth.
But programs put on for a general public, though it would have been a very small one at the beginning, are undertaken by 21 or thereabouts?
Oh, yeah. Well, the KDKA... First is the first regularly scheduled. They announced ahead of time, we're going to go on the air and give you the results of the presidential election. And therefore, that's considered regularly scheduled. Before, it was people on using telephone hookups or whatever at home playing records for somebody else 6 miles away who could hear it on his receiver.
But then the first broadcast as serious broadcast was... The election results in November 1920.
Yes.
And we've got here, provided by you, as you well know, a recreation of that broadcast. But the recreation, Cliff was saying, he thought dates back to the early 1930s.
I think it was made as sort of a 10-year anniversary or something, and they did not have an actual recording. It would have been possible to make an acetate disc or something, but they never did because they didn't realize fully the importance of what they were doing.
So this is the election in which
which Harding defeated Cox and his vice presidential running mate, Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah. And here is then a recreation of that broadcast only about 10 years after the original.
These returns through the cooperation and by special arrangements with the Pittsburgh Post and Sun. We'd appreciate it if anyone hearing this broadcast would communicate with us, as we are very anxious to know how far the broadcast is reaching and how it is being received. While we're waiting for the returns to come in over the telephone, direct from the Post and Sun, I'll give you the list of offices in today's presidential election. Here they are. Some 30 million Americans are electing a president of the United States, a vice president, 34 United States senators, 435 members of the House of Representatives, governors of 34 states, and thousands of minor officers, county judges, and officials. Okay, those are the offices to be filled. And here are the seven complete presidential tickets that are being voted on. Republican, Warren G. Harding, and Calvin Coolidge. Democratic, James M. Cox, and Franklin D. Roosevelt.
That's wonderful stuff.
Wow.
Does that come from a script copy of the original broadcast that they had? Do we know?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
No, I suspect they just went just in and made it sound as amateur as possible.
Uh-huh. By 4 years later, the election of 1924, radio was really there, wasn't it?
Very important. In fact, one editorialist opined in the New York Times that he thought that Calvin Coolidge's sharp voice did a lot to get him elected, because it came off so nice and clear through the primitiveness of the broadcasting.
Gee, that rather reminds me of an analysis I read some years ago of why, for a while, Kate Smith was the leading chanteuse in the country. And it was because when radio was still rather primitive technologically, her voice, which was a sort of a sharp clear voice, mm-hmm. just conveyed very well across the airwaves.
Right. I think the same thing is true for Rudy Valli had a voice that was construed to be a perfect microphone voice.
Was it?
That
yeah.
was specifically designed for.
I remember the sound of Rudy Valli on the air from when I was a kid listening to the radio in New York City.
Well, they considered him the Palace Theater of radio back throughout the 1930s.
He had a big variety program every week.
With major yeah. personalities.
In fact, I think Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy first reached radio through that program.
And it's hard to believe, but Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, by about 1938, were one of the top programs in radio, and one was a dummy.
Yes, it was yeah. a ventriloquist act.
Yeah, of course.
Conveyed by radio.
Now, I want to turn to Cliff's new book, American Babble, Rogue Radio Broadcasters of the Jazz Age. You reveal something I never knew, that there really was a very early conflict in the development of American radio. What was the nature of that conflict?
Well, this book is kind of about a class war and a culture war over mm-hmm. what radio should become. And when radio was new, it struck a lot of people as a really utopian technology that was going to bring all kinds of marvelous social dividends, universal education, the dissemination of high cultural values. Everyone could now listen to Beethoven. Everyone could acquire news of the world instantaneously. People were going to be improved. Society was going to be healed. Labor problems were going to go away, et cetera. It was just going to be a miraculous thing. This was primarily a middle-class ideology. At the same time, one of the things that sort of separates American radio history from that of just about any other nation is that the government was giving away broadcast licenses to just about anyone who put their hand out. So you went overnight from there being, I think, three radio stations in 1920 to there being about 500 or 600 just 6-7 months later. And a lot of the people who acquired licenses were not specifically interested in making these genteel dreams of utopia coming true. They were interested in making money from radio, and they turned very quickly to advertising, which is the thing that people who subscribe to these utopian ideals said radio must never be used for advertising. It's far too sacred. It's
who was arguing that radio must never be used for advertising?
Middle class opinion leaders across the board, but especially the national advertising industry, who were very outspoken mm-hmm. admirers of the BBC and wanted to do everything they possibly could to avoid seeing radio become an advertising medium. They thought it would be bad for radio, and they thought it would be bad for their reputation, for the reputation of the advertising industry.
And it turns out that quite quickly there developed two different kinds of radio stations, some run actually by large corporations and others little independent operations, and it's the independents who are pushing the high culture.
No, it's the independents who are pushing the low culture.
The independents are pushing the low culture. It's the corporate ones.
The corporate
who
ones
are not advertising their own corporations particularly, but are pushing the high culture material.
Corporate stations belonging to the likes of General Electric, AT&T, RCA, Westinghouse, and stations like this one, WWGN, belonging to the Tribune, tried to be high-class, respectable, culturally uplifting operations, were very careful if they dabbled in advertising at all to limit it to a kind of PBS NPR standard of what was called name brand sponsorship. Very, very polite, very careful not to step on anyone's toes.
I must give you something. I've just been doing some research while you've been talking. If you wondered what I was poking at on this computer, I've gone searching and I have found the original program, that is the content of the program, for the first broadcast by this station, WGN. It was they bought up another radio station that already existed in Chicago, and their first program was, what is the date? It's in 1925, I know that. I don't find the exact, yes, here we are. No, it's 24. On March 29, 1924, the Chicago Tribune's radio operations over what had been WJAZ began from the Edgewater Beach Hotel. And here is the listing of this mammoth program that they did on that day to launch this very radio station. Dinner hour program, 6 to 7:30. Dinner music from the Oriole Orchestra. Illinois, a state address by John H. Camlin of Rockford, Illinois.
Yes.
He was the president of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce. Illinois, a song as a baritone solo sung by Joe DeUge of Pekin, Illinois. He was the secretary of the Pekin Chamber of Commerce. A soprano solo sung by Monica Graham Stiles. Readings, I don't know of what, by Julia McGee. Dinner music by the Oriole Orchestra. Then the agricultural program, an address by O.J. Bradford, who was president of the American Farm Bureau. And Winnie Winkle, a soprano solo by Sarah McCabe. Baritone solo by George Smith. Again, the Oriole Orchestra, and they sign off until 9 o'clock. Then at 9 o'clock, they come back. 9 o'clock to midnight, dance music from the Oriole Orchestra, an address by E.F. McDonald, Jr., president of the Zenith Radio Corporation.
Yes.
You say yes, because what?
Well, he's a kind of a major player later in the story. He challenges the government's right to control licensees and assign them wavelengths, and this leads to a period of regulatory breakdown. He's kind of a rascal, actually.
Is he?
Yeah.
Then there's a song by a soprano, Miss Edith Mason, the prima donna of the Chicago Civic Opera.
Uh-huh.
Isaac Van Grove, conductor of the Chicago Civic Opera, is her accompanist. An address by Mayor William E. Deber. More dance music from the Oriole Orchestra, an address by John T. McCutcheon, the cartoonist, famous cartoonist, wasn't he, of the Chicago Tribune. News bulletins from the Chicago Tribune, a piano solo by Dean Remick, baritone George G. Smith sings something, an address by E.A. Bean, United States Supervisor of Radio, whatever that means.
He's a Department of Commerce employee, he's sort of nominally in charge of.
The Oriole Orchestra fills it again, an address then by William M. Dewey, the manager of the Edgewater Beach Hotel. Tenor Frank Fred Agard sings something. Bernard and Robinson, the Dixie Stars, sing more. Soprano Evelyn Converse sings. The Oriole Orchestra once again fills in. News bulletins from the Chicago Tribune from midnight to 3 a.m. Shall I go on with this? Let me see. R.M. D'Angelo, Edna Bennett, Herman Grunberg of the We've Got to Have Money Company, Fort Theater. Taylor Holmes of the Nervous Wreck Company, Harris Theater. These are all different theatrical acts taken from larger works that are on the stage, whether merely in Chicago or around the world. I don't know.
Probably
One
in
of
Chicago.
Them is Richard Bold, tenor of the George White Scandals Company at the Illinois Theater, and so on and so on. I could go on for quite some while. They do a special program for Australia and New Zealand listeners from 3 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Wow.
The air wasn't as clogged as it is now, and
yeah.
these signals could carry a long way.
Way less interference, yeah. So I think that looks like they're doing their best on perhaps a limited budget to you know, the local dignitaries and the mayor and the prima donna. WMAQ, which was also considered a highbrow Chicago station, their first three seasons was just nothing but opera. They were with Mary Garden.
What was happening on those small stations that you focus on in American Babylon?
Well,
one of them was up in Zion, Illinois, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Zion, Illinois belonged to a kind of. They were considered, the station there was called WCBD, and that was considered a farmer station, primarily of appeal to rural listeners. The what were called lowbrow stations in the city broadcast primarily downmarket vaudeville entertainment of the racier neighborhood 10-cent type, not the classy Keith Albee family viewing stuff, but kind of the racier stuff.
Burlesque skits,
and a lot of jazz bands from speakeasy nightclubs. Mm-hmm. They would just basically wire the place with a landline to the studio, and whatever the floor show in, you know, it would have been a Capone-run joint in Chicago, essentially, and the jazz band would play, and they would just mediate the ambience and atmospheres of a speakeasy into everyone's home, which was considered a terrible scandal.
Now, here may be an example of that sort of broadcasting. I go back to Fred's playlist. You want to say something about the Brunswick Brevities?
Well, that's an early example of how you can advertise in a minimalist way by naming your show after the sponsor and even mentioning the name several times throughout, but not actually developing a strong, what we would call a commercial.
But this is also a performance by a great jazz man.
Except he's not quite the great jazz man. Red Nichols doesn't have his pennies yet, I guess.
Red Nichols and his five pennies was a great traditional jazz band.
Yeah, but here it's interesting because the one way they have of advertising is, they want to know who's out there listening. So he will play five songs. I think I ran off three of them.
Uh-huh.
Five little phrases from five songs. And if you don't know all five, then there's something wrong with you. Write us, give us your name and address, and we'll tell you what the one is that you didn't remember. And in the process, then we develop a mailing list, and we get to know how many people.
Now, where is this broadcast?
This was a national program.
A national?
Yeah,
a network. This goes to
1929,
it says
here. Network started in 26, 27.
26, yeah.
Here it is.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Red Nichols speaking. I am going to play for you four choruses of old popular favorites. I will not give you the names of these selections because I want to see how good your memories are. If you do not remember the correct titles, write a letter addressed to the Brunswick Balt Colander Company of Chicago, Illinois, or send correspondence to me, care of the station to which you are listening. The correct titles will then be sent to your home. I thank you.
Bit of a fade. We are late for some commercials, which I expected would be the case. We'll pause for those and then on with the history of the early years. It's really the first two decades of American radio, maybe the first two and a half. We return to Cliff Dirksen and to J. Fred McDonald and to lots of other additional illustrative material after these words. And I will once again say, as I did about half an hour ago, that that station break, this is WGN, the voice of the people, is given by Ward Quall, who started at this radio station in 1936 or 37 as an announcer, as a kid, I think, out of Peoria. And then, for many years, in the post-war years, was the general manager of this station, as well as of WGN television. And Ward is into his late 80s, I guess, and is still around and still runs his own corporation as a consultant to broadcasters. And he was on with us just about a year or two ago on a full two-hour program commemorating some aspects of the history of the station. Continuity is just a wonderful thing where you can locate it.
True. As you mentioned, when you were reading the original broadcast, they kept interrupting, or they were regularly scheduled interruptions for the latest news. And it's still a WGN and, of course, many other radio stations, hallmark. So, in other words, GN has been broadcasting the news since it began.
Everybody knows where the call letters came from. You know, don't you?
World's greatest newspaper.
World's greatest newspaper. But, Fred, a number of the stations in Chicago have call letters that relate to the corporations who originally owned them.
Well, the world's largest store.
That's
WLS. That was Sears.
That was Sears.
That was a Sears.
They no longer own WLS, but WLS is still there.
Oh, yeah. That passed a long time ago, their ownership of that station. But that was often throughout the country. The people or a corporation would buy it, and it's another way to advertise your store or your university or whatever.
What was the station, when I first came to town, which was 1965, rather a while ago, a station that was owned by AFL-CIO, probably?
WCFL.
And CFL stood for what? Chicago Federation of Labor.
That's right.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it was a big rock and roll station
in
the 60s.
How did that... We know how the struggle between advertising and just high cultural programming without advertising came out. The commercial side won.
The lowbrows win.
Well, if you want to call it lowbrow.
I'm using the language of the time.
Was that fated and inevitable, or could it have gone otherwise?
I think it was probably fated from the moment that there was that they opened Pandora's box and distributed those hundreds and hundreds of licenses to all and sundry. If you look at nations that took the opposite track, in Britain, the government sits down with the big corporations who are interested in broadcasting, and they say, okay, we're going to form a cartel. There'll be a centralized system. You guys will finance it, and we'll make budget back from taxing listeners and selling them a scheduling publication, the Radio Times. That's how the BBC is born. It's a cooperative agreement among the equivalent of the Big Four in the United States.
The same would be true, I guess, basically of CBC up in Canada.
Yes. Canada's, as always with Canada, kind of a mixed condition, because there was some sort of already a private system, but much smaller, much less developed than in the United States. And the CBC is kind of a BBC-like retrofit after the fact.
But of course, we also have public broadcasting. I guess it was added on later, wasn't
it? Way later, yes. So, yes, Britain and America have kind of converged in that the once iron monopoly of the BBC is now diluted with privately owned commercial competition, and similarly, the United States now at least has some public radio and PBS.
Fred McDonald, going back to your history of American radio, don't touch that dial. Finish the following sentence. In the 1930s, American radio was
a major adhesive to keep together a people who could have split in a lot of different directions because of the pressures of the Depression, the pressures of foreign wars, of mounting international tensions. We know we had a nativist movement, we had a fascist movement, we had a communist movement, but the popular culture, not just in radio, but particularly in radio, because it was sort of the poor man's entertainment, because you had it all the time. All you had to do was pay the electric bill and buy a set.
What you've just said about the Depression and how we faced the Depression stimulates me to jump ahead on your playlist. So I say to my friends in the booth, let's go to cut number 11. And you want to explain what that is? Buck Jones. Who was Buck Jones?
Buck Jones was one of the great B-Western movie stars of the 20s and 30s, who later died in a fire at the Coconut Grove Hotel in Boston in the mid-1940s, supposedly helping people get out. But he was on radio, and here he's talking.
He had the Buck Jones Rangers Club.
It's like a little fan club for all the boys and girls out there, but particularly for the boys, and because they were always the heroes of the B-Westerns.
Yeah.
And what he's doing is he's telling you we got a new man in the presidency right now who's getting things done.
This is 1933.
33, but he does it in the rhetoric of a cowboy story.
Uh-huh. Here it is.
What's the first offering on the Hollywood on the Air program tonight? Buck Jones, one of the best horsemen and cowpunchers to stand before a camera, is going to say a few words to the 2 million young boys throughout the nation who belong to the Buck Jones Rangers. Buck took time off tonight to talk to his little pals, although he was busily at work until an hour ago at the Universal Studios on a new serial, Gordon of Ghost City. All right, youngsters, get up close to the radio. Here's Buck Jones himself.
Howdy, boys. I thought we ought to have a little powwow tonight. I'm going to talk to all you young fellas as if you were all members of the Rangers. Far be it from me to make a patriotic speech, but we've got a man in the White House who's doing a mighty sweet job of organizing America and heading her back towards prosperity. With the summer vacation time coming around, I want to call your attention to a few little things you can do to help Mr. Roosevelt put this big job over in a big way. Times have been pretty tough. Times have come when every youngster, boys and girls too, must pitch in and do something that will help Ma and Pa make the home a little happier and the going a little easier. This depression is like a kink in a rope, and you youngsters can straighten it out by doing a little fancy roping yourself. That is, if you set your mind to it. You're growing up, you children, and you've got to look years ahead.
It ends rather abruptly. This
excerpt. That's the only segment that exists from that actual broadcast. But it's kind of priceless in the way he approaches children. But above all, it's radio, in this case aimed at children, suggesting patience. Things are being done. Stay together. Stick together. Do what you're told with your parents. In this case, follow the rules. And we will get out of it.
It's a campfire chat instead of a fireside chat.
Yeah.
For the kids.
Well, the little buckaroos.
Yeah.
Did radio, in fact, once it became a presence in American life, as surely it was by the 1930s, did it serve to sort of normatize and unify American life? Did it help to produce a consensual common culture?
Yeah, I think that's the part of the prediction that the utopian sort of forecasters of the early 20s were making, that did come true. The only difference is that the expectation at the time was that unifying power was going to be refined and genteel and would take the form of Beethoven rather than jazz, that it would not be a vaudevillian unification, that it would be something a little bit more highbrow.
But the good jazz that was being played in the 1920s was just as significant as was Beethoven's Fifth.
But it was seen as the gangster rap at the time.
Yeah, I mean,
it was not art music. It was not given any intellectual credence. It was a scandal, and the idea of, to a lot of people, to hear the jazz on the air was an almost blasphemous misuse of the technology. The jazz only becomes now it's of course practically become high culture itself. It has, in fact.
Oh, sure.
At the time, it certainly was not seen that way. It was seen as the worst thing to happen to music ever.
It was also black.
It was black.
And this is a racist country in the 1920s. And therefore, putting black culture out there for wholesome white people to hear was considered insidious, if not corruptive.
Now, one of your books, Fred, a book that we talked about at the time, deals with, well, one title was Blacks and White TV, Afro-Americans in Television Since 1948. Wasn't there another book that dealt with similar aspects of radio?
There a chapter in the first book
on
the history of African-Americans on radio.
I confess that when I was a little boy, my parents used to listen to and enjoyed, and I became dimly aware of what was once a very popular American radio program, Amos and Andy. Which also had some connection with this station, did it not, originally?
Yes, it started out as
they were Sam and Henry. on WGN, then they went over to WMAQ.
And got a better contract.
As Amos and Andy.
And changed their names.
Coral and Gosden.
Yeah.
Yeah, Freeman.
Two white guys.
Charles Corral from Peoria.
Yeah.
And a lot of people come out of Peoria.
A lot of radio talent came to Chicago.
Yeah, Jim Jordan and Marion Jordan, Fibber McGee.
Jack Brickhouse.
Oh, there you go.
And various others. Do you think then that the white-black difference was augmented and sort of reinforced by the way in which blacks were represented on American radio?
Amos and Andy was enormously popular among black people at the time.
Among black people
as
well.
Yes, it was.
It was very
absolutely
funny.
Huge. It was
very
it's a very funny program.
Yeah.
Where it is not popular is where blacks and white mix. Because if you are laughing with me, it's one thing. But I can't be sure you're not laughing at me. And middle class, an emerging middle class black population hated it. The Baltimore Afro-American and other Negro press newspapers went after it, tried to sue it in court to stop it from being broadcast. They considered it a denigration, and they did the same thing when it hit television in 1951 and finally basically forced it off the air and into CBS's vaults.
The irony of that story is that it wasn't until Amos and Andy were actually played by African-American actors that it was driven off, while it was still
That's when it went to a television
program. Well, television.
Well, it hit the civil rights movement. There is civil rights movement in the 20s or 30s of any great impact.
The great line from Amos and Andy, which I remember, was spoken by the Kingfish, who was a subsidiary character, who would often say, "Now see here, Andy." And I tell you, now see here, Fred, and see here, Cliff, we're late for some commercials. Here they are.
Okay.
And we return to J. Fred McDonald, who is the president of McDonald & Associates, that great historical film and radio archive, which is regularly, which serves the interests and the needs of all sorts of broadcasters. And Clifford J. Dirksen, an operating critic at Time Out Chicago, an interesting fairly new magazine. When did it begin?
We're on our 17th issue coming out next week.
I've been looking at it on the internet
we're
since
weekly, so.
I discovered your book and discovered you. And that new book by Cliff Dirksen is American Babble, Rogue Radio Broadcasters of the Jazz Age. That's published by University of Pennsylvania Press. Fred, since we struck the tone about the election of Roosevelt in 1932 with Buck Rogers coming in to relate to the kids how he was handling the Depression.
Buck Rogers.
Buck Rogers is the man up in space, right, of course. But here's another presidential candidate from 1932. You want to explain this?
Eddie Cantor is probably the first one to a popular personality to try to advance his career and make some jokes playing a candidate, a bogus candidate for the presidency. And this is him suggesting in late 1931 that he just might be the answer to the Depression in 1932.
Is Cantor the first of the comedians to have a regular weekly comic program?
He is really, along with Rudy Valli's variety show and Amos and Andy, these are the three driving forces to come out of the 20s, maybe the Goldbergs in the afternoon, sort of serial drama, are the major forces to come out with big personality names. Cantor was major and helped to draw people into this new medium.
And he did a weekly half hour.
A weekly hour.
Chase and Sanborn
hour.
When did he begin, do you know?
1928.
So here he is, a veteran already in 1932, announcing his presidential candidacy.
As you know, ladies and gentlemen, our Mr. Cantor is not only America's first comedian, he is also a literary celebrity and a rising statesman to boot.
A statesman to boot? There's an idea.
Yeah, I thought you'd get a kick out of that one, Eddie.
Hey, wait a minute. Who's the comedian here?
As I was saying, ladies and gentlemen, our Mr. Cantor is a brilliant statesman as well as a comedian. The Cantor 5-year plan for removing the well-known Depression, as outlined in Eddie's new book, Yoo-Hoo Prosperity, has been hailed by right-thinking citizens everywhere as pretty darn nifty. Already the word goes round. What about Cantor in 1932? In fact, ladies and gentlemen, Cantor and prosperity are just around the corner. Only Eddie has arrived first. And so, we give you for president, the Honorable Mr. Eddie Cantor.
Yay!
ladies and gentlemen, my hat is in the ring. My hat is in the ring and my overcoat is in hock. Thank you, citizens. Thank you. After all, is it so strange that I should be president? Haven't we had funny fellows in office before? Why, we've still got them. There's only one trouble. Maybe I couldn't be president on account of my connection with Flo Ziegfeld and Sam Goldwyn. You know, Flo and Sam are now right in the middle of a big fight over my services this winter. Ziegfeld wants me to work for Goldwyn, and Goldwyn wants me to work for Ziegfeld. Elect Cantor president, and they'll both win. Anyhow, it's time something was done about this here now, about this depression. It's terrible, you know. Things are so bad, my friend Groucho Marx tells me that on the Boston Common, the pigeons are now feeding the people. Folks are not spending. Everything is cheap, but nobody is buying. Even those who don't intend to pay aren't buying. Everybody is saving up for a rainy day. If they only knew it, it's pouring pitchforks right now. Still, don't despair. Remember the proverb. When the wolf is at the door, look for the silver lining. Elect Cantor and the wolf will die laughing. In my own case, the depression brought a strange result. Before the crash, I had $1 million, a house, 3 cars, and 4 daughters. Now all I've got left is 5 daughters. Others have cut down on everything. I know families who owned estates and belonged to fashionable golf clubs. Now they live in caves, and to keep up appearances, they play miniature golf with tapioca and toothpicks. At the summer resorts this year, millions of mosquitoes died of hunger.
Well, that is interesting. As I listen to that, it surely isn't like modern stand-up punch-punch kind of delivery. It's almost reflective.
It's almost an oratory rather than a comedic style. But he doesn't have an audience. And early comedy didn't have live audiences. They later developed that to give them something they could feed from.
Well, we heard a crowd cheer at the beginning.
Well, that was the cast.
Uh-huh.
About 20 people there yelling, including the sound man probably and everything else. But it is, it will later, of course, develop that patter style that's almost machine gun-like. Bob Hope was the prince of them all. He could do 80 punchlines in one half-hour show. He was considered to be the most verbose of the comedians.
But comedy as a major feature on American radio on national networks doesn't really emerge until the late 20s or on into the 30s.
Well, it doesn't on the corporate stations. It does on the lowbrow stations, who are continually featuring. I mean, local vaudeville performers would show up to do their shtick. There was a sort of continual sort of interaction between low-end vaudeville and these mercenary.
Now, who are the three or four local stations that you treat specially in your new book, American Battle?
Let's see, Chicago stations, by the way, of lowbrow. WBBM was at the time considered a. Is that the right? Started by these boys, the Atlas Brothers, who are WBBM, was considered at the time an extremely racy station, and it broadcast.
Racy in what sense?
It broadcast nightclub jazz, and jazz was a scandal. It broadcast, black bands, not the sweet white dance bands.
And how did it morph into the WBBM of this day?
That's beyond my period. Well, it eventually affiliated with CBS.
Yeah.
And CBS had a certain, a program list that you accepted, and it filled out most of your day. It was characteristic. That was the kind of CBS was the second network, and so NBC had cherry-picked all of the respectable.
But then BBM
stations.
Became a news station and has been that for I don't know how long.
Well, that in the 1960s, then, as radio isn't quite the same phenomenon that it is up until the late 50s.
Demoted.
Television is its undoing, of course.
It's undoing or the transformative influence.
Well,
radio is still there. It still makes money.
Yes, it makes money. And
people still listen to it, after all. By the millions.
There are 8 or 10,000 stations now. Back in the days of network radio, there was something like 800.
So it's still a flourishing business, though. It transformed itself.
It had to, and it did, of course. But television took all the major advertisers, all the major stars over to it, and it just became the visualization of radio. And the proof is the very fact that the same networks that ran radio ran television.
Television also took over from radio as this monolithic medium that reached just about every demographic, whereas what happens to radio is that it falls apart into serving different smaller demographics, which is why you get for the first time youth-oriented radio, a separate radio, rock and roll radio for teenagers that happens at this point, because they're looking for little markets.
But you know, curiously, some of the most successful commercial radio stations in this country are general service stations doing programming rather like this radio station. In fact, this radio station is one of the most successful and most listened to stations in the country. And it isn't all that different from what you had on radio, I would say, back in the 1940s or 1950s. It's different, of course, but it still has a varied content. Well, maybe it's a little bit less different because it's basically built around talkers, isn't it?
Talkers or
all
sports?
All the shows are talk shows.
Or sports.
There are special sports talk shows. There is, of course, sports coverage, which is a very important feature.
Not a lot of serial forms anymore.
You know, it's very interesting. If you wanted to go to cut number 14,
yes,
to hear when television is first emerging, to hear how excited the radio people are, not knowing that, in a sense, it's going to change everything for them.
This sounds fascinating. It's a demonstration of television over at Marshall Fields in 1939.
Yeah, the RCA people took televisions all across the country to major department stores to show what it was like.
We're going to hear that, but not directly, because some commercials are in fact due. When we take care of those in a brief newscast, we'll go directly to that clip. Once again, that was the voice of Ward Quall, who for many years was the general manager of this radio station and of the television station as well, and started as an announcer at this radio station in 1937-38, thereabouts. I don't have the exact date in front of me. We go now to that other great event in American broadcasting, the introduction of television. Actually, it came just around when Ward Quall had started to work here as an announcer, didn't it?
Right.
1939.
Yeah.
So we didn't get it commercially till after the war, I think.
It started in 39 with the World's Fair.
Uh-huh. In New York City.
In New York City, in a 50-mile radius of several stations there. But the war interrupted everything, and they continued to experiment throughout the 40s, but not until 1946 did they come back with much more purpose.
Don't I remember reading someplace that actually the companies that were working on it, Westinghouse and RCA, whatever, were actually doing experimental broadcasts in the late 1920s?
There were, I think, sort of experiments, but nothing that you would regard as continuous programs.
No, it wasn't broadcast quality.
No, it would be broadcasting, you know, to other engineers to see, and how will the makeup work, what kind of formats will work. But they were on maybe 2 hours, 3 hours a week, because it was, about 1927, 28, you started to get the first experimental broadcasts. And
but in 39, they come to Marshall Fields with, who brings the set around, and
This is RCA. That's why RCA. This particular cut is from WMAQ, the RCA station. And they had gone in Oregon to a major department store in Portland. They had been in Los Angeles, and they were coming across the country. And they came to Marshall Fields, and they had a studio set up on one of the floors, and you could go in and see yourself on television.
It's an entire road show built around a single television set. It's really hard to imagine. Yeah.
And who do we hear on this?
It's just the announcer for WMAQ, but he's so excited about this wonderful miracle of the 20th century without really understanding fully what its impact is going to be.
Here it is.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're speaking to you now from the Palm Beach-like atmosphere before the Klieg lights here in the television studio on the fourth floor of Marshall Field and Company's great store in the city of Chicago, where RCA Victor Mechanism is being presented to the public eye this week to show the American radio public just what has been perfected in the way of television. And they are witnessing here this afternoon the performance of the iconoscope, which is a camera-like device which picks up the television image, and also of the kinetoscope, which is the very sensitive tube which reproduces the image in the television receiver. There are two studios here on the fourth floor of Marshall Field. One is the television studio for the picking up of the image, and in it is this large iconoscope, a camera-like device on a tripod. Television image. I see we have about a minute here before we'll have to sign off. So let's look around here. Well, we are so short of time, it's best that we don't break into an interview because we'll have to break it off short. But we've just talked to you for the television studio here at Marshall Field. We'll let you hear Mr. Atkinson, who is the official greeter at Marshall Field. We've let you talk to Mr. Walter Lawrence, Mr. Charlie Alba, and now it's time to say good afternoon. But we must tell you again that it is a miracle that's being presented here at Marshall Field, this thing called television. A miracle engineered by RCA Victor and presented to the farsightedness of Marshall Field and Company's great department store in Chicago. And you should avail yourself, if you do nothing else, of the opportunity of seeing this in its perfected form, both before the iconoscope in flesh and blood, and later reflected upon the cold mirror after having traversed miles of wires. It is, indeed, the greatest achievement of the 20th century. And now...
But whatever happened to the iconoscope and the kinetoscope?
They became the television camera. They got a little streamlined.
They were struggling for a vocabulary.
Yes, yes.
The time.
In fact, sometimes they called it a kinescope, which later became a term for a film
made of a TV program. Thousands of kinescopes.
I have lots of kinescopes.
Collection at
the
archive.
That struggling for a vocabulary occurs with radio too. Initially, I mean, as late as 1921, they're not using broadcast consistently. And when they use it, they sometimes say something was broadcasted. They're saying things are shot from, or relayed,
or a web is a network.
They had all these different sort of fumbling attempts before a vocabulary for what it is was fixed.
At the peak of American national commercial radio are great series, great recurring features. One of them, surely, and it was one of the most long-lasting, was it not, was Fibber McGee and Molly.
Oh, yes. It ran until radio, the old style of radio basically died in 1960, and Fibber McGee and Molly would show up occasionally on Monitor, which was an NBC umbrella package. But it started in the mid-1930s, grew out of a Chicago radio act, two Peoria, a man and wife from Peoria, Jim and Marion Jordan. Hit the networks in, about 1938, was almost immediately in the top two or three programs. It certainly was the most popular sitcom, eclipsed Amos and Andy by the late 1930s, and remained a major, major funny program throughout the 40s and into the 50s.
Shall we listen? She used to say, "'Tain't funny, McGee," but it was funny.
Hold the ladder, Molly. I'm coming down.
Well, what for? You've only taken down two screens.
I know, but I feel kind of faint.
Oh.
Help me down, will you?
Oh, you poor dear. Oh. Oh, my.
Yeah.
Where do you feel the worst?
Up on the ladder.
Well, now, there's only one thing for you to do, dearie, and that's go to bed. Now, come on in the house and lie down.
Hey, wait a minute, Molly. I can't go to bed. I just happened to think there's a smoker at the club tonight, and I got to interview a lot of talent. Did I tell you about that guitar player I discovered? He's terrific. He's marvelous.
Now, don't excite yourself, McGee. You better run up to bed.
Oh, I don't want to go to bed.
You're going to bed.
But, Molly, I don't want...
You're going to bed.
That's what I say. I think I ought to go to bed. On second thought, Molly, I'll just lie down here on the davenport.
Come in.
Good day, madam. I'm from the Whistler Vista Exterminating Company. Are you troubled with pests?
Yes.
What kind?
Salesman from Exterminating Company.
I get it.
Who was that, Molly?
Oh, that was just a man from the Exterminating Company.
Oh, too bad you couldn't give him some work to do, Molly. Them poor fellows just live from hand to mouth. Oh, am I sick.
You must.
I'll get it, Molly. It must be that guitar player.
Lie still, dearie. Lie still. Don't exert yourself. I'll answer.
Charming, but really rather simple and naive, isn't it?
It was every man. Fibber was sort of supposed to be the average guy next door, but it's filled with puns. In fact, most radio comedy was puns. In fact, I think about 1932 or 33, somebody figured like 80% of the jokes on radio comedy programs were puns. And
I guess they were easier to understand than complicated, more intellectual types of comedy situations.
33, 34, that's also, that coincides with the moment when all of that utopian enthusiasm for the wonderful things that radio was going to do in the same sort of journals of opinion like Atlantic Monthly or Harper's or Saturday Evening Post, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you started seeing articles saying the exact opposite, saying radio is ruined, we've degraded this, it's just this decaying toy, another advertising
sounds rather
medium.
Like what people write about television.
Well, it's what people have never stopped saying about, you know, any given medium ever since.
But
that was
happened,
the moment of disillusion.
What had happened is the Depression hit. And all of those vaudeville entertainers had to find new jobs because vaudeville wasn't working anymore. Mm-hmm. And many of them flooded into radio, like Jack Benny in 32, like Burns and Allen in 32, like Groucho Marx and his brothers in 33. They all came into radio.
If
with
you're running down that roster of great radio comedians, do not neglect the greatest of them all, Fred Allen.
Fred Allen, another vaudeville performer, mm-hmm. they all come into radio with their vaudeville lowbrow humor, if you want, and that must have, you know, it was, the fate was sealed. Now you've got major names who are developing relationships with the listening audience, mm-hmm. and it's never going to be the same. So
that
you're...
That vaudeville boom sort of reflects the moment. The networks are, especially NBC, are the inheritors of the corporate genteel tradition, and when you see that vaudeville boom coming on, that basically represents, from the perspective of their critics, a lowering of their standards. They're retreating from this promise that they made. You know, Merlin Aylesworth, who is the sort of the programming chief of NBC, went before Congress and said, we're never going to make money with this, we're here to bring culture to the masses. And there's this massive retreat once the real depth of the Depression hits, where you see the formerly highbrow stations really gravitating toward the condition of what was once exclusively the independent radio stations.
Which stations particularly?
Which stations? Well, WEAF is the flagship of, it was a station founded by AT&T,
uh-huh.
and it's basically, AT&T has a special relationship to advertising. Mm-hmm. They're sort of, they for various complicated patent reasons, think that they have a monopoly on it through most of the 20s.
When I came to consciousness as a little boy in New York City,
mm-hmm.
WEAF was there. It was then part of NBC, I believe.
Yes, it's the flagship of NBC.
And WJZ was another NBC station, and they represented two different networks within...
The Blue and the Red Network.
The Blue and the Red Network.
Right.
What was
right.
that about?
Basically, I think it was the Blue was kind of the tonier one, and the Red was considered...
Actually, what it was, they had two networks, but they had them drawn, the red lines that connect all these together,
uh-huh, yeah.
WEAF is the home station, the blue lines with WJZ.
Yeah, the names were arbitrary.
And the Blue Network was the less famous. In fact, when the Supreme Court in 39 ruled that this was a monopoly and it had to be broken apart, the Blue Network drifted off as the Blue Network, and then it was bought up by the Lifesaver Candy Company and became the American Broadcasting ABC. Company in 1944-45.
Really?
Uh-huh. But, and then let's not forget one other important one. These are all owned and operated and affiliated. But there was a cooperative attempt of major stations to come together to create their own network, which was the Mutual Broadcasting
right.
Company. And WGN was the Mutual station here in Chicago. And they often say the station that brought it all and made it all possible was WXYZ in Detroit, which had mm-hmm. the Lone Ranger. And in order to hear the Lone Ranger, you had to go to Mutual.
It had the Lone Ranger, and I think it had the Blue Hornet? Is that?
No, the Green Hornet.
The Green Hornet.
Oh, yeah. No, the Green Hornet was the same people. Sergeant Preston of the Yukon.
Same actors, yeah.
And Sergeant Preston of the Yukon turned uh-huh. Tonto into a dog and Lone Ranger into a Mountie.
Really? Switched to Flight of the Bumblebee for...
Right, the Rossini's overture to...
Yeah. Old-time radio in the sense of replays of those programs of the sort that we've been talking about and many others whose very titles we haven't mentioned, is still, old-time radio is still a great and enthusiastic commitment on the part of millions of people, I think, around the country. They get it by listening to certain old-time radio replay broadcasts on occasion, and, of course, by buying copies, which are now available in ultimate supply.
Milt, it has changed. I mean, I was a collector of old radio on radio tapes starting in the 70s. You trade them off. There is a place on the internet right now where for $240 you can get 94,000 radio programs on 90 DVDs. You can get 850 Jack Benny programs. Every program on the Fibber McGee and Molly list.
You've done me a very great service and given me a wonderful gift tonight. You want to explain what it is?
That is 75 and a half hours of Vic and Sade, a quarter-hour comedy show, which, was, as everybody in the audience knows, is your favorite radio
program. It was my favorite on a nostalgic basis, and you were very fond of it, too.
Oh, yes.
We once did a whole program of Vic and Sade clips from your archive. Vic and Sade was a great Chicago-originating daily 15-minute
very
comic serial.
Very witty, very funny, and we also had on that first program, you may remember, one of the actors.
Billy Idelson, who played young Rush
the son,
on Vic and Sade.
That's right.
And was, at that time, a producer in Hollywood. I trust he still is.
Yes, and we were able to get him on the phone, and it was memorable.
But the point you were making about how compacted it all is now, I got this one DVD, which I'm holding right in my hand at the moment. You say 75 hours worth?
75 hours, and that didn't even fill up the DVD.
Did you say 95,000 hours?
95,000 programs.
Programs, okay.
What is that, 50?
What, average half-hour length?
500 gigabytes or some...
So you could
500
offer,
gigabytes of information?
I could offer my child all the benefits of a Depression-era childhood if I just buy enough of those programs.
You could. And, you could easily do that.
Yeah.
Well, 95,000, that's how many... That's what portion of all the fare that was on American radio.
Well, it's I have no idea. They don't have the mundane daily things, but uh-huh. they've got, every major drama show, every major Western, every major, even major sporting events. Just what a collector would take years or a lifetime to develop can be yours for $240 on the internet. It's just amazing.
Where it will all end knows God.
Yes.
You recognize that line?
No, but I agree with
it. It's Wolcott Gibbs's or somebody's profile of Time Life magazines back in the 1940s or 1950s.
Backwards ran the sentences until reeled the mind.
Backwards ran the sentences till reeled the mind.
Yes.
And the last word is, the last sentence is, where it will all end knows God. That was in the Time.
Yeah. The Time style.
The Time style, which inverted the clauses in sentences. We pause for some commercials and then a few more clips, but also rather shortly on to the phone contribution. So if you want to call to raise a question, offer a thought, give a memory that you think worth sharing, we'd be delighted to hear from you. As ever, the number 591-7200. And if you're listening to us in Tokyo or in Kuala Lumpur or in Baghdad over the internet and want to be in touch, the easiest way, of course, is via email, the email address extension 720 at tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word at tribune, tribune.com, or 591-7200. We're ready for you. Get your calls and emails in quickly. We'll return right after this. And we'll go to the phones quite soon. But before we do, one more cut, Fred, from the rather generous batch that you brought in. We haven't been able to play all of it, of course. And this relates to another unifying service that radio provided at a time of great national crisis, one might say.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, your commercial for the U-505 should remind us of the tremendous role radio played in keeping the country informed and united during World War II, a war that the Americans didn't want and had thrust upon it in both instances by the Germans and by the Japanese and the Italians, who all declared war on the United States. So that... The idea of providing entertainment in that place of the war is one thing, but the government actually used, and private industry used, the radio to send out very important messages. And what we have here is a couple of pieces. One talking about victory gardens and how important a victory garden was, which was the idea you find some spare land around your house and you grow your own vegetables, and that amount of vegetables could be then sent to the troops to eat rather than you wouldn't have to buy it in the stores. And then the other is the conservation of gasoline, something we should also think about nowadays.
And these are from sort of the middle years of the war, are they?
1942, 43, yeah.
Here they are.
Meanwhile, we have another story vital to every American today. The food situation is critical. All of us are going to have to pitch in and grow some of the food America needs this year. That's one reason why the United States Department of Agriculture asks for 18 million victory gardens. Your victory garden will be a serious undertaking. You'll want to do everything in your power to make sure that your seeds come up and that they grow into strong, vigorous plants, just as a commercial grower does. And that means two things: fertilizer and seed treatment. A special victory garden fertilizer has been authorized by the government, containing nitrogen from organic sources and from chemical sources like DuPont Uramon fertilizer compound. You'll be able to buy this victory garden fertilizer.
Fall in, everybody.
Hey, what is this? I'm not in the Army. I'm a civilian. What do I have to fall in for?
To help our country through this serious gasoline and oil shortage. Fall in with your neighbors and add your strength to the civilian Army mobilizing to cut gas and oil waste wherever and whenever it can.
Well, what can I do? I'm just an ordinary guy.
Ordinary guys can stop racing their car motor. Ordinary guys can cut off their car motor while waiting for friends. Ordinary guys can avoid racing up to red lights, can shift gears faster, can reduce speed on the open road and maintain an even speed always, can have their carburetor and ignition checked frequently. And ordinary guys can cut down on the use of their car by driving places with other ordinary guys whenever possible. Fall in, everybody. Help our country save gas and oil. Make 2 gallons do the work of three.
Very interesting. All the more so because you said to me while that started playing that the man who did the first clip was the radio actor who played Superman.
Bud Collier also was very prominent in 1950s television, often as the host, quizmaster, or game show host on afternoon television.
Did he do the opening announcement for the Superman program? Look up in the sky, it's a bird,
no,
it's a plane.
No,
it's
he
Superman.
Was Superman.
I know.
No, he didn't do it himself. No, it was a female voice or a younger voice, but he was.
But the fellow who played the Lone Ranger did the opening for the Lone Ranger, did he not?
When the man who did the Lone Ranger died, the announcer then was brought over to play the role.
Bremer, was that his name? Something like that.
Brace Bremer, yeah. But the Earl Grazer, the original one, was killed in a car accident.
I see. Gentlemen, let us go to the telephones. 591-7200 is the number. And, of course, there are loads of people clamoring to be in touch with you. And here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
I got a question. I got two questions. First question, I want to know what the first AM radio station was that broadcast out of Chicago. And my second question is, what did the call letters WMAQ actually stand for?
Fred knows those things.
He put me on the spot. I really don't know those things. Do you know that WMAQ stands for? Or are you? It is possible that they could have call letters that didn't stand for anything.
Yeah, often the call letters were assigned arbitrarily, and then the meaning comes after the fact. If the call letters that you want were spoken for, stations would often invent, acronyms or whatever.
They had some rather abrasive announcers and newscasters. Stood for moderately abrasive and querulous.
It's possible.
But the it's interesting too. We had talked about KDKA, yeah. And the very fact that you find the K stations, for the most part, west
of the Mississippi,
and the W stations east of the Mississippi, except a few of them were grandfathered in. KYW in Philadelphia
sure.
is a good example.
Now, this listener also asked, what was the first commercial station in Chicago? Is there a contest
guess,
about that?
I think WMAQ, but it wasn't really very commercial at first. It was entirely without commercial content.
Uh-huh.
Its first two, I think it goes on the air in 1922, and it's basically doing nothing but relaying opera broadcasts from Mary Gardens. It was the prima donna, and they were basically all opera all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind if some station rendered that service.
It's
days.
Not a format that's around anymore.
I guess not. 591-7200, the number. You are the next caller. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Bill Curtis, I'm just going to deviate a bit from what I wanted to talk about. Bill Curtis started out here in WIBW. They built themselves as the first station, and they say that they got in an argument with the station in Philadelphia.
Now, WIBW is where?
It's now in Topeka, Kansas.
In Topeka, Kansas.
And they got in an argument about, who was the first station, and they couldn't settle it except that they could say that one of them was the first commercial station, mm-hmm. and this one belonged to Kansas State University. It was really a, you know, like a public broadcasting station.
Well, I think you were suggesting earlier, were you not, Clifford, that there are a number of stations who contest for the title of having been the first.
There
station.
Are four major claimants to that title of being first, and it all, you know, the answer of which one is really the first depends on how you tweak the criteria, what sort of definitions you assign to it. But David Sarnoff was asked, he was the head honcho of RCA, and he was asked sometime in the 40s or 30s, I think, well, who really was first, and his answer was, he was the kind of personality, if he could have taken credit for it himself, he would have, but he was excluded from doing so in this case. And what he said by way of reply is that it's not an answerable question. He said, too many of us were working with the lights out, and when the lights came on, it was no longer clear exactly what anyone had been doing. So it's really not ultimately an answerable question. You can always find a precedent before the precedent.
Our thanks to the caller, and we follow an old and great radio tradition. We pause for some commercials. And once again, our thanks to Ward Quall. It's a good deal, I think, when the man who runs the radio station has in fact worked as a radio performer. Our new general manager at WGN, Tom Langmire, started as a talker in radio. I think the newsroom work as well. And interestingly, he came up here from KMOX in St. Louis, which does a very similar sort of programming mm-hmm. to what we do here. 591-7200 is our number as we return to the callers. It suddenly occurs to me to ask, you've done broadcasting, Fred.
Yeah, well, I had a show on WBEZ.
Yeah,
for a couple
it ran
of
for
years.
A number of years. It was general political commentary, was it not?
Well, no, it was a program, was a historical documentary series called Journeys, and we would do a one-hour program that would be half-filled with old cuts as uh-huh. this evening, and then a patter between myself and my co-host or an expert brought
but you
in.
You used to do political commentary. I blended the two things. For Sandra.
Sandra Gares. On her program on the afternoon on BEZ, I was a political commentator for about 3 years.
Yes, indeed. Have you ever, in fact, Clifford, been a broadcaster?
No.
Not even at the university?
I was interviewed on public radio previously, a feature about payola that I was talking about as an historian. But this is my first time on live radio.
Are we whetting your appetite?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, this is fun.
We might try to find a gig
for you. It's interesting. Good. Okay.
591-7200 as we go back to the phones. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Milt. It's such an interesting show. I used to be on the radio at the early 50s, the end of the 40s, on Uncle Ned's Squadron, and that was Ned Locke. Do you remember Ned Locke from Bozo Circus?
Wasn't he the ringmaster of Bozo Circus?
Yes, sir. Well, yeah. This was the show before that, and that was from WMAQ.
Now, you were on doing what?
I was his executive officer. I was probably 10 years old, and I had a script. Every week there would be a script.
How wonderful.
To tell about my airplane rides.
Uh-huh.
And my question is there any way to ever find these shows that I could hear them again? I know they're recorded.
Well, that was WMAQ, was it?
Yes, sir.
Then the first thing would be to ask them if they've got an archive of their old stuff. I would bet the answer is no.
I bet the answer is yes. They don't have the archive, but they donated it to Northwestern University years ago.
Oh, you know that for a fact.
Uh-huh, because I went in and copied it all onto audio tape.
Then the full archive of Uncle Ned's?
If it exists, it would be in my collection at the company.
Isn't
but the whatever happened to those original discs, they were lost, thrown away. They turned the storage area into a dormitory. But they have been saved on tape, and if indeed we have them, you can...
How would I find them, please?
You get in touch with McDonald and Associates. You want to give a phone number for the company?
773-267-9899.
Great. Why, thank you very much. Milt, you have the best show.
Tell me this. Did you stay in radio after that?
No, sir. What happened... See, there were two shows. There was a show at 9 o'clock with Norman Ross Sr.
Uh-huh.
A Carnival of Books. I used to be on that as a pinch hitter. If a kid didn't show up, I would then be on it.
I see.
And then at 10:30 was Uncle Ned. And then at 1 o'clock was a double feature at the movies. So I wasn't terribly interested in radio. I had to see my double feature, serials, et cetera.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
It's been delightful to hear from you.
Thank you. Bye.
And to another caller instantly, hello, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you this evening?
Fine, thank you.
I was so excited to hear your little excerpt of Fibber McGee and Molly. Having a father who used to come home and find us watching Brady Bunch reruns on television, I've gotten the whole rundown of everything that they used to have to just listen to, and my father has talked about Fibber McGee and Molly to me since I was old enough to remember. And you talked about a website, so I was really interested. I thought, you know, what a fabulous Father's Day gift.
Oh, that's
actually
wonderful.
Give him the Fibber McGee and Molly set.
Well, you could. I think they sell it for like $3 if you want just the Fibber McGee and Molly. But it is www.bookzap.com. And they offer a tremendous amount of entertaining radio for a very affordable price.
And they record it on DVDs.
On DVDs and CDs, yes.
And regular CDs.
Yeah.
That would be great. I'm sure Fibber McGee and Molly isn't the only one he was a fan of, but I've been hearing about it for years, and I've never actually heard.
Well, you can give him 850 copies of the program.
Well, there you go. That's a heck of a Father's Day gift, isn't it? Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. Glad to have heard from you. And we go directly to another 591-7200. You are next on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Milt. I'm really enjoying the show.
So am I, to tell you.
I'd like to relate one of the stories. I'm working with a WLS historian and quite a few friends, but the story of the Hindenburg, the reporting of the Hindenburg is extraordinary. And it is one time in the history of the NBC network when it was red and blue that they both simulcast the same news event.
And is that the famous one from which the clip comes, Oh, the Humanity?
Right, that's it. And that's all the people get to hear is the clip. They don't get the lead-in. Now,
yeah.
The History Channel had a little bit on the reporting of it as they were doing their story on the Hindenburg, but what happened afterward you could make a movie out of, as is they finished the recording, and the Nazi SS had figured out that a recording had actually been made, and Charles Nielsen tried to call across the river, so I think it was WAF, and said, you know, to get it on the air as quick as they could. And his lady at the operator says, oh, we're tied up. The phones are all tied up. We don't have time. It's been a terrible disaster at Lakehurst, and we're trying to get reports. And he's got the whole report. Well, they were playing cat and mouse, keeping this recording away from the Germans all the way back to Chicago. In fact, when they got back to the studios at WLS, they were waiting for them. So they slipped in the back way, immediately made copies, and immediately put it on the air. And at that time, both NBC, Red and Blue, were switched together. And it's just an amazing story how they got to Lakehurst, New Jersey, to begin with, because Burrage Butler didn't have any interest in going out there to report this. And
let me check out with
Charles
Fred
Nielsen had gotten some free tickets.
Fred, do you have all of this in your book?
Yes, it was a man named Herb Morrison who
Morrison did the broadcast.
And he was just out making field recordings when this happened, and then all of a sudden he has the most important recording on a disc that anybody could have. And
that was lost, and we found it in Danville, Illinois. And unfortunately, as many, many radio stations, this happened in 1960 when ABC Paramount took over the Prairie Farmer WLS. All that history went down the coal chutes and into the trash. Some was donated. It just got scattered.
Well, you know, a large part of the archive that Fred has accumulated over the years is based upon the retrieval of discarded material, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That's what makes this valuable, is because it is, in the long run, it's just only a small part of the whole legacy if we had saved everything. But saving costs money. saving, you need space, you need reason to save. Why would a station save old radio discs when they could use the facility to a better advantage, to a profitable advantage? And so they dump it. Fortunately, for the WMAQ, which we spoke about earlier, somebody had worked with a professor at Northwestern named Martin Maloney and said, let's call Maloney and see if he would like it. And he took it.
Martin Maloney was the father of Cordelia Maloney, who worked as the producer of this program for a few years.
Yes.
Rather a while ago.
Yes.
I just wanted to add, as far as programs being destroyed and thrown away, the border blaster stations we were talking about, the pirate stations on the Texas-Mexico border, they used to record their...
Selling monkey glands and things
yes,
like
monkey,
that?
Yes, monkey, goat glands.
Goat glands,
yeah. Operations, rejuvenation. They would cut their recordings onto these large aluminum transcription discs, and afterwards they would show up on as roofing materials on local houses.
Oh,
they would just be thrown out, and so people would like hammer these onto their, make a nice sort of shiny shingle roof out of them. And that's where a lot of them ended up.
How dreadful. What a terrible...
It's like the Alexandrian Library all over again.
You could have taken apart some roofs and maybe find retrievable material that would play.
Possibly, with the computer technology now. It's not excluded, who's to say.
Let me ask you to respond to this, though, an email. Could your guest discuss why shortwave didn't become a major force in American radio? After all, it has a much greater range than AM. And why even today does the FCC discourage domestic shortwave broadcasts?
Shortwave, of course, was one of the early experimental forms. And when World War I broke out, the U.S. Navy took over the complete control of all radio and streamlined everything so that it made the commercial type of radio much more profitable, much more accessible, easier to deal with. Shortwave radio is, you're talking to a man who actually went out and bought a shortwave radio set so I could pick up foreign countries, but you often find that it's just government propaganda or some church station down in Quito, Ecuador, and or Radio Moscow. And it just never had much to offer, and the transmission was spotty. You had to have a certain kind of aerial, run a wire around the house in a certain direction, so it was a lot more difficult to work with.
Of course, now the ultimate and the great alteration in radio technology is the Internet.
Oh, that's an amazing...
We are heard all over the world, and it's still a delight, it's still a great surprise.
And
we get an email while we're on the air from somebody listening in Tokyo or Kuala Lumpur or one of those other places, mostly in the Pacific, because... Well, there was a group of ladies, who, one of them wrote to me once, emailed me, to tell me that their little luncheon club often tuned in this station in Sydney, Australia.
Well, you realize that we're only about the year 1923 in the history of the Internet compared to the history of broadcasting. Imagine what another 50 or 60 years of Internet will mean.
Well, can anyone explain to me exactly what podcasting will do, and for that matter, what a podcast really is?
A podcast is a downloadable MP3 file that, for instance, I could put on my iPod Shuffle here and listen to it at my leisure. So I could take this program, if it were available as a podcast, and put it on my iPod and listen to it tomorrow on the way to work instead of having to be at my radio between 9 and 11.
But I understand that there are now also podcasters working as talented amateurs who are doing their own radio performances on pods, or
it's pure podcast. There is no streaming show. It's just there for you to pick up
there
at your own leisure.
How do you get it?
You just download it off the internet from their
it's
website.
It's there on the internet. Yes. You can download it and listen to it.
Yes.
Yeah. Another former producer of this program is now a BBC broadcaster and BBC writer as well, and is become their specialist on podcasting, is doing a special BBC feature on podcasting, and he recently interviewed me for his pod, which at the same time is put on the internet by BBC. I don't fully understand it.
But it's amazing, though. You don't understand it, but it just amazes the potentialities.
As far, can I just add that what's interesting about the internet radio phenomenon is it's also a coming full circle technologically, because prior to broadcasting there were experiments in various communities, mostly in the Northeast, at wiring homes telephonically and distributing what were essentially broadcasts, except they were coming over wire. So distribution of wired music. There were commercial companies that tried to make, actually, I think Muzak basically grows out of one of the Muzak company grows out of one of these concerns. Mm-hmm. And so again, this is not being broadcast through the air. This is, we've just come sort of full circle back to what's also a kind of an archaic approach to the distribution of sound.
And importantly, the word broadcast doesn't really apply. Broadcast was looking for the maximum audience.
They do now talk about narrowcasting, don't they?
This is narrowcast, the narrowest casting in some cases.
Well, the word broadcasting, it's an agricultural metaphor. It means to throw seed widely, actually. That's where it comes from.
We are overdue for a last round of commercials, and here it is. And directly back to J. Fred McDonald, Professor Emeritus of History at Northeastern Illinois University, a great resource on the history of radio and television, with many volumes on those subjects to his credit, and the president of McDonald & Associates, a major historical film and radio archive based here in Chicago. And Cliff Dirksen is a critic at Time Out Chicago magazine, a PhD in history, isn't it?
That's correct.
From Princeton just a few years ago.
Yeah.
And the author of the book, to which we haven't done paid full attention, but it's, I'm happy to recommend it as just a fascinating treatise, quite well written, I might add.
Thank you.
Titled American Babble, Rogue Radio Broadcasters of the Jazz Age. And that's published by University of Pennsylvania Press. And we go back to the phones on 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening. Your program brings back memories. There used to be one in Chicago. I think it came in WGN, Little Orphan Annie.
Oh, sure.
Sure. She and Sandy.
Who's that little chatterbox? The one with
little golden locks.
They weren't golden locks. They were auburn locks.
Yeah.
Is that right?
She and Sandy made a pair. They never seemed to have a care.
Yeah.
Who could have? Yeah. I remember a friend of the family. I think the radio name was Joe Corntassel. I forgot his real name, but I got a big kick out of the Lone Ranger. Every day he'd have a message on his decoder ring. Numerical numbers would correspond to helpful characters. And his friend Tonto had a saying, "Hoa hosa waki," but you had to be a member of their special club, because I remember getting a wolf paw jacket. If you send in so many gum wrappers, you got that jacket.
Now, Fred McDonald can elaborate on some of the things you've mentioned.
Well, I think you're mixing a lot of those up. There was a program sponsored by Wrigley that was something, the Indian one you were talking about, because Tonto's phrase was kemosabe, which, of course, was the camp where the producer's children went to a summer camp in upstate Michigan.
Was it? I never knew the origin of that.
And George W. Trendle, and his wife was an English teacher, so the Lone Ranger always spoke in proper English.
He
didn't have any slang. And the Indian was a Tom Tom or something like that, which was a short-lived show. And Captain Midnight, of course, had the decoder ring with the little message.
Yeah.
Our thanks to the caller, and we move quickly to another. And here is that next one. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Wonderful program and a wonderful radio station.
Thank you, sir.
I'm calling from Holland, Michigan, and I used to work in small market radio here, and just wondered if your guest could comment on, I left radio because it's become so automated and it sounds the same everywhere you go on some of those stations where I used to love traveling the country, and you could pick up the local flavor of an area by listening to their radio.
Well, lots of the stations are essentially untouched by human hands. They're all automated, aren't they?
Right. Yes.
I drive past the radio station where I used to work, and there's no one there. Just a couple of hard drives, and it's a dark building.
How is that handled technically?
It's just the modern technology makes it possible. One person can do it in Dallas, Texas, and put it out everywhere.
And feed it 20 other or 100 other stations.
Especially when a company like Clear Channel owns, a good percentage of the American broadcast market.
I think the caller's exactly right. It's really disheartening the extent to which that treatment of radio leeches all of the local character. And one of the fun things about researching my book American Babel was that it gave me a chance to recover the stories of these essentially crazy regional stations.
But then again, one might say again, as I will say again, that is why stations like this and KMOX and WOR in New York and a few others work so well,
distinguish themselves from the pack.
They're local, they have good broadcasters, And they have a wide reach as well, usually.
They're late to the homogenization process, but WGN Television just announced it's getting rid of its afternoon cartoon shows to put in more reruns of, sitcoms. WGN got rid of Bozo on the television. Mm-hmm. The things that make a broadcaster distinct are all gone now, basically. And back in the 50s, you had the big networks, but GN held out. It was affiliated with a mutual and the Dumont networks, but it was the major independent. That's all gone. And I suspect, however, what is happening with radio is happening with all of our culture. There are Walmarts everywhere selling the same stuff. And pretty soon the Walmarts will be in Karachi. They'll be in, you name it, around the world, and we'll all be streamlined, homogenized, and pretty much the same. And everybody will speak English because it's the lingua franca of business.
But there's sort of these countering currents. Milt was talking about podcasting. There are all these kind of weird fringe media that are cutting in the separate, in an entirely opposite direction. I think there's possibility for some serious growth there and recreation of diversity.
Quite possibly.
Of course, that's what we say, you know, that's the sort of utopian projection that people make every time a new medium comes along, and so.
It occurs to me, going back to our playlist, that there's one item you have here, Fred, that we just have to work in as our sort of farewell cut, and it's Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. That originated from Chicago as well, did it not?
Chicago with a great WGN, or in this case it was an NBC broadcaster, but Franklin McCormick was very distinguished on WGN for decades.
And we will hear him, I guess, announcing on this very clip. Here it is.
Jack Armstrong,
the All-American Boy.
Wave the flag for Hudson High, boys. Show them how we stand. Every Star team be champions. Known throughout the land.
Wheaties, Breakfast of Champions, bring you the thrilling adventures of Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. Say, if you're any kind of a sports fan, I'll bet you'd be mighty happy if you had a date to eat breakfast tomorrow morning with a bunch of great athletes like Bob Feller, Ernie Lombardi, Hank Greenberg, Joe DiMaggio, Dixie Walker. Well, you know, if you were to see those fellas at the breakfast table, you'd make a mighty interesting discovery. You'd find that every one of them calls for his Breakfast of Champions regularly and often. And that's for sure. You see, hundreds of great athletes in just about every line of sport you can name rate that combination of Wheaties, milk or cream, and fruit their favorite training breakfast cereal. And for some mighty good reasons, too. In the first place... And now, Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy.
The schooner Spindrift, slipping through a calm sea, is now in sight of Honolulu. The western sun is sinking into the horizon, lighting up Diamond Head with its golden glow.
Well, we won't get the adventure because time is almost gone, but that was Franklin McCormick.
Yes.
Who was basically a major figure at this station, but he was the announcer on that one as well.
Yes.
Originating from MAQ, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of these actors drifted from studio to studio.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And,
some of the veterans tell you, at least they told me 10 or 15 years ago when I had some of them on, that they all belonged to what they called the Bridges Up Club. It was their way of making an excuse if they were due at WGN, having just come from WMAQ or vice versa. They could say if they were late, the bridge was up, I couldn't get over here.
And that happens even yet.
I suppose it does. Well, this has been an interesting traversal of a period in American radio. How distinctive is it, or did the other countries... the other modernized countries go through essentially the same in the development of their radio?
Nothing as the flowering here of commercial radio, the flowering of the attempt to appeal to the mass at the expense of the elite.
And that indeed is one of the basic points that Cliff makes in his
this
book.
Is a clear-cut case of American exceptionalism. The history here, no one else ever took it up, no other country thought, well, let's just give away radio licenses to all and sundry and see what happens.
And let the market forces determine what it's going to be.
It wasn't even that thought out. They just didn't have a legal mechanism to deny people licenses, and that's why all this happened.
But the Republicans of the Harding administration, led by the Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, could never have conceived of state-controlled radio. It had to be open to the capitalists. It had to be open to exploitation.
But Hoover was a big opponent of advertising.
He said for a short while.
For a short while. If they'd known what they were doing in 1919, say, when they put RCA together, they would have definitely organized a monopoly.
I think you might argue that, though you may, there may be some dysfunctional consequences of that, or the consequences that don't fully suit your taste, that basically it has served us well in that we do let a thousand flowers bloom, and our radio is open to full expression by those who want to pay for the expression, I suppose, rather than being under state control.
No argument there.
The BBC is very much a creature of the government that runs,
but they also
the
have
Kingdom.
Independent radio, independent television stations as well. And
yes.
Sky TV is a good example of that.
The BBC of today is not the BBC that was created in the 20s. I mean, that was a genuine monopoly and a very paternalistic one. And
we gentlemen have used up all of the available time, and you have my profound and truly enthusiastic thanks for joining us tonight. Our guests have been Clifford Dirksen, whose new book is American Babble, Rogue Radio Broadcasters of the Jazz Age, published by University of Pennsylvania Press, and an old and treasured friend, J. Fred McDonald, who is, of course, the president of McDonald & Associates Historical Film and Radio Archive.